in the past.
Novelists promised to create a better world. They had different ways of achieving this, but their power and authority came from the disingenuous way these novels infiltrated book clubs. Because of this, people began to lose faith. They were intimidated by the fact that they had to read books, sometimes for the first time in years, and discuss them with their neighbors. They were shocked that they were asked to discuss literature while eating delicious scones and drinking good wine. Some of these readers were influenced by the writings of a reclusive and batshit crazy philosopher named Leo Spritz, who became the father of the book club movement in the 1950s, and believed that a white wine spritzer was the way to get people talking about literature. He was later to become the inspirational force behind many of the One Book, One City reading programs, as well as an unintentional influence upon early instant messaging programs and ska music. Without Leo Spritz's philosophy, it is likely that you wouldn't be listening to this podcast. Perhaps cowering beneath a fleece blanket, waiting for the mustard gas to hit the streets of New York, or worse yet, Peoria. None of this has any relation to the interview to follow, but we hope that we have found a few unlikely connections that will scare the living bejesus out of you. More importantly, this allows me, a leftist BBC Two documentary producer, to fulfill a troubling commercial obligation.
So, I am here with Dave King, who happened to be in San Francisco, the novelist of The Haha, which I named as one of the top 10 books of 2005. Dave, how you doing?
I'm good. Thank you very much for naming the book to the list. I'm really happy that you did that.
Well, I'm sure you are. Well, I wanted to go ahead and get the sort of, you know, you've done a tremendous number of interviews for this thing, I know, and so you've probably received the standard questions, so let's get those out of the way right
okay.
now. Okay. Now, you started off as an artist. You actually had a roundabout kind of way of getting into novel writing. And I was wondering if you could possibly describe this in a way that is... I'll see if I can actually get you off the track just a little bit.
Okay. Well, my undergraduate degree was in painting and film. Mm-hmm. And after I graduated, I went into painting. I was a pretty serious painter. And I had a little little studio on Avenue B in New York and painted every day. And I didn't achieve a lot of success in terms of shows and selling paintings and stuff, but I had a great time, and it was a really wonderful period. In fact, if you look at the art world of the early 1980s, you probably won't find my work represented, but you may find me represented as a model. I did a lot of modeling for other people's works, and some of those paintings actually became famous.
Huh.
And from there, I had the opportunity to paint a mural for someone, and then a partner and I started a small business doing decorative painting and trompe l'oeil and marbleizing. And these were the Bonfire of the Vanities years, and we were almost immediately became very successful. Within the first couple of years, we were working for ex-presidents and foreign princesses and at the State Department and the Metropolitan Museum of Art and doing really, really well. And that was a lot of fun, but after I'd been doing that for like another decade, I realized that I had drifted rather far from the kind of creative life that I'd set for myself. And in particular, that although what we did called for craft and you know, a certain amount of care, it didn't have the same high stakes as being an artist. And to just kind of relieve that, I took a class in writing at the West Side Y, and then I took another one, and I was lucky enough to study with some really great people: Naheed Rocklin, Amy Hempel, Melvin Jules Bouquet. And at one point Melvin called me up and he said, you know, I think you could take a shot at writing, but you haven't thrown your hat in the ring. You're clinging to this day job that you have, and you do it very well and everything, but how are you going to feel on your deathbed if you haven't, you know, written anything? And that really struck a chord. It took about a year to transfer my business to my partner and apply to graduate school, and then I went to the MFA program at Columbia when I was about 40, and from there the story is probably very much like most writers' stories, yeah. except that it's happening to a guy in middle age rather than a guy in his 20s.
So it seems to me that you have like a greater sense of ambition than the norm, because for a lot of people, like, they hit their 30s and then all of a sudden, like, you know, I'm going to go ahead and, you know, start a family, blah, 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 or like work some job and I'm going to give up on my dreams. But in your sense, and it's also reflective, I think, in your novel, in the sense that, you know, I don't know, I mean, maybe you could describe this sort of sense of ambition that both fueled the writing of the book as well as you as a person. I mean, this was, you know, as I know, this was like, you know, labored over for like 7 years.
Yeah.
You know?
It may be ambition. I think I'm lucky in that I'm by nature the type of person who takes stock fairly regularly. Mm-hmm. You know, every couple of years I look at my life and I really subject it to a pretty harsh assessment and ask myself if I'm where I want to be. And often I've switched gears, you know, and I think I'm maybe a little more of a risk taker than some people. I mean, I always figure, well, if this doesn't work out, then I can do something else. And that was my attitude towards, you know, getting out of my successful business and going into writing. It just seemed to me like, well, I'll just give it a try and see what happens. I can always go back to painting or, you know, go back to cab driving for that matter. You know, there are always things to do.
So you need kind of a high-stakes kind of situation, I guess.
I guess I do, although now that I'm settled down, I mean, I seem to now be a novelist,
yeah.
Whereas, you know, there's always a temptation to, like, you know, go to Undertaker School or something like that. And, but I am going to write another novel at least. So,
okay, great. Well, I wanted to go ahead and talk about the inspiration for Howie or Howard. I know that your brother was autistic, and you sort of adamantly sort of suggested in the piece for Once Written that this was not, in fact, the chief source. But I'm wondering how much of your own experience you drew upon to sort of develop the character. Where does Howie come from? And, you know, I mean, maybe you could talk a little bit about this. It seems
sure.
It's interesting that, you know, you have this level of ambition, which is kind of sort of there in Howie, but in a different sort of almost kind of, I don't know, antithetical sense to some degree. You know?
It's funny that you keep coming back to ambition, because, you know, if you ask my father if his son was ambitious, he, you know, he'd tear his hair out and go like, oh my God, he's done one thing after another for the years. No, he doesn't have a clue. But yeah, I'm happy to talk about the relationship of my brother Hank. The reason I like to stress that Howard Kapostash is not kind of a giving voice to my brother is that my brother was autistic, and Howard has brain damage. And
yeah.
I just feel that readers are smart enough to understand that those are two very different conditions. They're both, you know, on some level disabilities, but they're really different. And for me, the crux of the matter is that my brother was born with his disability, whereas Howard acquires his. And so thematically, what's important in the novel is that sense of loss. And Howard's loss of his voice, his loss of his aspirations and what he feels he's entitled to as a young American, and his loss, in fact, of a future. And I think that my brother probably did not ever look around him and say, gee, what would things be like if I were more normally abled? And so that's the real difference between them. At the same time, obviously, having a disabled brother gave me an interest in disability. Having a brother that didn't speak and writing a book about someone who doesn't speak, I mean, that doesn't seem plausibly coincidental. You know, there's some connection there. And I think as a writer, I'm naturally drawn to language disability, because I think forms of language and the way we express ourselves and don't express ourselves, those are just interesting concerns to me.
Well, there's actually something interesting you do, speaking of language, in the prose, where you italicize certain words like recall and people and accomplished and program. I found this to be a rather sort of funny little comic subtlety, in the sense that it's almost kind of like these self-help terms are kind of italicized throughout the work.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. I wonder if I don't think anyone's ever noticed that before. I mean, I did think a lot about how to use the italics, how much italics I was going to give Howard, trying to give him, you know, a kind of ebb and flow of his emotions in his long interior monologue, but also occasionally trying to give trying to use the italics to express things that he would say if he could. But that's wow, that's really observant. Nice
well,
one.
Yeah, well, I mean,
good catch.
Well, there's the thing is, I guess because the thematics of the book, the thing that made it such success for me anyway as a reader, is the fact that you juxtapose Howard's kind of like, you know, sort of struggle to sort of like find a life against all these various forces, including like Sister Amity, for example, who are trying to sort of correct him and place him.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a very unique kind of juxtaposition that I guess really sort of I think it struck a chord for me, particularly since you took this material and made it sort of so unsympathetic. I mean, in the sense that, you know, you didn't play up the sort of sympathy angle. I guess
I tried not to. Yeah.
I wanted to. I mean, since you took like, you know, many years to sort of do this, I was wondering what steps you took as a writer to kind of just like bring this kind of, you know, I guess juxtaposition, so to speak, into the actual text. How many drafts did this take? Did you, you know, was there some sort of like clinging sort of treacly part of you that you just had to like, you know, throw into the closet or?
Oh, you got me. let me just say a few words about your first point. Yeah. And then I'll return to the question of method. You mentioned that Howard is resisting people's efforts to pigeonhole him, particularly
yeah.
Sister Amity's. And I think that's true. One of the things I was interested in doing is portraying a lot of characters who are struggling with their identity in some way. Howard is trying to be more than just the local disabled guy. Sylvia is trying to be more than just the coked-up mom or the single mom.
Yeah.
Ryan is struggling with his identity as a mixed-race kid. And so that was one of the things. I tried to give everybody sort of several, at least dual identities, and in some cases more than that, that they had to kind of address in order to show that everybody had, you know, kind of a richer character.
Yeah.
As to the way the voice grew about, I think one reason the book took so long was that I did a lot of experimenting in creating the voice, and probably the weirdest thing that I did, well, I should say first that I spent a lot of time thinking about the nature of consciousness and reading about consciousness and reading theories about, you know, what it feels to think and what it feels like to think. And it's a really interesting field, and one thing, of course, that I uncovered is that the inside of everybody's head is unique and known only to themselves. So I know what my thoughts feel like, but I can't know what yours, Ed, feel
yeah.
like. And I had this idea that it would be amusing if the inside of Howard's head was poetry, but none of the other characters knew it, but the reader could understand that. So I decided that the book would be a novel in verse, and I actually rewrote about 80 pages of it in iambic pentameter before I sort of came to my senses and realized that, you know, Milton was Milton and I'm sort of not Milton. But that...
You are Nelson, though.
That, right. Then I put it back in prose, and I think that was, you know, that served to sort of articulate the difference between Howard's own sense of himself and the rest of the world, and all these various experiments sort of created that divide between Howard's inner life and his external life, which is pretty crucial to the novel. So I tried to develop them sort of side by side.
So it seems to me that, you know, and this is something I, you know, even like David Foster Wallace, he, like, for example, came by recently, like a couple months ago, and he was talking with Rick Moody, and he had revealed during the course of this conversation that, you know, here's a guy who's like, you know, a virtuoso stylist.
Yeah, he's totally great.
And but at the same time, he had apparently tried to write this utterly sort of sincere kind of novel, and in his words, failed. So it seems to me, I guess what I'm getting at here is from you is that basically you initially tried this very stylistic exercise, and it almost takes, you know, it takes probably great bravery as a writer to sort of go beyond that and just say, okay, you know what, I'm going to get over myself, I'm going to go ahead and write about this sort of like, you know, this character, because, you know, everything is very sort of declarative sentences in
mm-hmm.
this, you know, and all that. I guess at what point did you know that this sort of style, the stylistic, you know, sort of approach was kind of out of your system?
Well, I think that the book has a particular style. I
yeah.
mean, it has a style that's largely composed of declarative sentences, as you mentioned, but it really has a rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And it always kind of surprises me when reviewers say, like, oh, so much is accomplished with this really, with, you know, really simple prose, because it's actually very careful prose.
Yeah.
And I have heard a lot of, I've heard from a lot of musicians who've written me or emailed me and said that they've been struck by the sense of rhythm in the paragraphs. And I think that probably is a vestige of the iambic pentameter, that it does that the prose has a beat, even if the sentences are not elaborately constructed, you know, multi-clause affairs.
When did the present tense sound kind of come into play when you were, you know, writing that? How did that develop?
Pretty early on. Pretty early on. I mean, one of the things that I tend to do is go towards the unlikable. And I know that so many people dislike the first-person present tense that it seemed really tantalizing to try to make it work. And I did actually at one point put it back into third person, and I don't know, I didn't seriously ever consider taking it out of present tense, but it needed to be in his voice, and I think that the present tense contributes again to that sense of consciousness. I mean, we feel like we're in his thoughts as the events are happening, and that's important to the reading experience.
And for those who might quibble, there are a lot of sort of flashbacks to his previous life, so you get a little bit of past tense too.
Absolutely, and that makes it very easy to signal to the reader, like when he's, you know, when he's remembering and stuff.
Well, it also struck me, you know, present tense seemed very appropriate given that he's going through a crisis, so to speak, or like a sort of identity. You're trying to figure out his identity over the course of the book. You know, the present tense seems to make the most sense, at least, you know, I don't know.
Good. I'm glad you felt that way, because I felt that way. But I do know that there are a lot of readers who, you know, kind of just resist present tense and also particularly resist first-person present tense.
Well, if you had written this in second person, then we'd have to have a serious talk.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, well, I wanted to talk again about the sort of, like, the efforts to avoid the sympathy. It reminded me, particularly since you labored over this for so long, it reminded me very much of Richard Yates.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that...
Well, that's pretty high praise.
Well,
I mean, I'm obviously, as you must have guessed, I mean, I really adore Yates. I think he's terrific.
Well, the thing is you get a similar sort of, honed, chiseled sense of rhythm in Yates's work as I kind of got in this. And I was wondering just, like, you know, how much, you know, we didn't really sort of answer this in terms of how much you stripped away of the sympathy or the didactic or anything like that.
I'm glad you came back to that, because you're right, I forgot to answer it. I was fairly far into the first draft when I realized that I probably wrote about 7 complete drafts, although I rewrote certain troubling passages as much as 20 times, particularly the beginning and end. And the ending I changed many times. But I was pretty far into the first draft of the book when I realized that it wasn't going to work if it was cynical or if it was sarcastic, that it really had to be sincere. And so then the problem became, as you suggest, how to be sincere without being treacly and sappy.
Yeah.
And there were a number of things that I did, you know, kind of, in terms of the rhythms of the scenes, following something that is, you know, that is very emotional with something that's not. I mean, those were just sort of technical things. But I also realized that there were certain key points where I wanted the reader to cry. And, you know, for someone who's a bit of a wise ass and, you know, knows his way around the world, that was a big realization for me, that I wasn't going to do something that was, like, funny and comic and sarcastic and everything, but that was actually sincerely going to try to elicit tears. And it was hard. It wasn't that easy. And I did, at one point, as you suggested, one of my early endings was a serious, serious misstep. It was like a Hallmark card ending. And it was the one that I turned in as my thesis for Columbia. And at that time, I also gave it to a number of friends. And so they read it, and in the middle of the book, they would call up and say, oh, I'm enjoying the book. But then nobody talked to me when it was over. And I went to a party, and there were a bunch of people who had read the book, and no one would look at me. And I had to, like, go out on the steps with a beer and think, like, what's going on? And I, you know, I sorted through it, and I went back in, and I said, oh, the ending really sucks, right? And they went, oh, thank God you figured that out. No one knew how to tell you.
Wow.
And it was I mean, so embarrassed. Please don't ask what it was. It was really, really dumb.
Oh, well, what was it? Can you at least hint? Maybe we can work out a compromise.
There
here.
Was a birth.
Oh.
It was really bad.
Man. Okay. Well, you know, at least you came to the, you know, the ending where there are no sort of clear-cut issues.
And Ed, you have an exclusive on that. I've never revealed that before.
Woo! All right. I've got to, you know, say everything's the best book of the year.
That's right.
Well, what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, I mean, going back to this issue of the fact that, you know, the sympathy isn't like, you know, sort of, you know, expressed on the page, but comes more from the reader response. This is something that probably was, you know, probably a bitch and a half to, like, try to get, you know, how did you sell this thing? You know, how did you get this thing published? Because, I mean, you know, particularly now where they're looking for those Hallmark happy endings, mm-hmm. they're looking for those romps or those picaresque kind of books, you know?
It wasn't actually that hard to get the book published, and I was surprised by that because when I was working on it at Columbia, it wasn't clear to me or to anybody that this was a big promising project. You know, a lot of people said, you know, you can't carry off this interior monologue for 300 pages. Mm-hmm. And then there were other people who said, well, you know, no one wants to read about Vietnam and no one wants to read about disability. And so I just said to myself, well, it'll be published and maybe 5,000 copies will come out and then I'll move on and I'll start my career. But I think because I was so hard on the manuscript, I really got it to the state that I wanted it to be, and it worked for me, and I'm a pretty serious reader, and I made the book that I wanted to read. And then to my astonishment, after that, getting it published was quite easy. I got an agent, a wonderful, really smart agent who really believed in the book, and I was very lucky to be working with her. And then when she sent the book out, there were several publishers who were interested in it, and there was this astonishing day in 2004 when the phone was ringing with you know, several offers, and so it wasn't that hard. I'm embarrassed to say, but it was hard to write the book.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's actually also interesting. You mentioned Vietnam, and I wanted to get into the sort of the war element of the pain of war that sort of comes from Howard. Well, first, there's a couple of questions I have on this. One is, was Tim O'Brien ever an influence on this? Because all of his work deals with a lot of this, too.
Well, one thing I should say is that I missed Vietnam by a whisker. I was the last year of I was the last year of the lottery, which was the year that they didn't take anybody for the draft. I had a low number, but they didn't call any numbers that year. And I don't think the war ended particularly abruptly, but for me as a teenager anticipating being called up, it seemed like all of a sudden it ended and it was over, and I had avoided this tremendous catastrophe. And when something like that happens, and particularly if you've grown up throughout your childhood thinking, gosh, I'm going to be in Vietnam in 5 years, 3 years, 2 years, whatever. You know, you think about what might have been. And I have always felt that way about the war. And when American literature began to appear, including Tim O'Brien, Susan Fromberg Schaefer, Tom Jones, Philip Caputo, Michael Herr, any of these people, when American writers began to respond to Vietnam in such a wonderful way, I was very interested and very engaged. I've read, you know, many, many of those Vietnam books, and I read them with tremendous admiration. I do think that, like, the one thing that kind of came out of the catastrophe of Vietnam is that American writers responded with tremendous, you know, integrity to it. And occasionally a reviewer will say that my book belongs in the literature of Vietnam, and I'm really happy with that. You know, that obviously makes me feel terrific.
Well, it's also because during, like, the 80s, there was, like, a lot of films and literature that mm-hmm. dealt with, like, coming to terms with Vietnam. And then, like, sort of around the 90s, the interest seemed to drop off a lot. And so your book kind of stands as kind of a unique... I mean, there aren't that many Vietnam-related sort of books in literature right now.
And you're right that they all came out during a 10-year period, and then it kind of, you know, dwindled off. Yeah.
Even Tim O'Brien stopped writing about it, like, in the
exactly.
90s,
yeah.
know?
Tomcat and all those things,
Well, I mean...
But, you know, he's, I think, quite aside from the Vietnam stuff, he's such a great writer and such an important and interesting person in terms of form, in terms of the structure of those, particularly the stories and the things they carried. And I have taught those stories again and again, and I think I've learned a lot from his approach. He has a particular kind of circuitous way of getting at the narrative, which I really admire. And my narrative is much, much more straightforward, but I certainly have learned a lot from, you know, what he does.
I'm curious also if, given the fact that it was such an extraordinary kind of character, a very unusual sort of situation, whether, like, you know, speaking of the circuitous routes, or even, like, you know, sort of going into kind of surrealistic or possibly magical realism routes, was this ever... You had mentioned the sort of, like, you know, the early kind of poetic version of the book. I was wondering if there was any impulse within you to, you know, do anything beyond keeping it real. Did you keep it surreal at some point? Or?
I think there are parts where the book moves into a kind of more poetic, more surreal language, and they're usually times of kind of elevated emotional experience. The time that Howard first describes driving the tractor up the Ha-Ha, you know, it kind of immediately switches into a very dreamlike description of his injury. The sex, I think, is described in terms that are like more poetic and more exaggerated than the rest of the book. And so that kind of thing was definitely an intention. I think in terms of structuring the narrative, the only part of it was, you know, allowing him to go back and remember things periodically. Yeah. But the particular innovation, the only structural thing that I think is notable is that we don't learn about his rehabilitation until very late in the book.
Yeah.
The story is almost over before he goes back and tells us about, you know, how he got to where he was at the beginning.
Well, there's also elements, for example, when he's looking for Ryan, and he's almost in this sort of, like, you capture this sort of suburban kind of community with a sort of, I don't know, descending into a state of nature, or possibly even going back to the jungle, or going, you know, that seemed to me a very, I think there's the character, I believe, who is, like, frozen or something, that he sees, he doesn't know who it is, and I don't know, I mean, that it seems that there is a touch of this kind of, like, you know, going into a sort of, the more he comes to terms with his emotions, the more he's willing to actually access these feelings, the more poetic the book sometimes actually,
yeah,
you know.
Absolutely. And in particular, that night when he has his breakdown, I mean, it does become more and more like a bad dream and more surreal. And, you know, I tried to control that, but also, since the book is about consciousness and feeling, I tried to give that a different feeling and a different way of being read. The other thing I'm sorry. You mentioned something, and I was going to respond, but I think I lost my train of thought.
Oh, maybe I was talking about sort of the state of nature. And,
yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
For me, I think that's something that I'm really interested in, and it's not a new subject. I mean, obviously, you know, Wordsworth and Coleridge also found, you know, transcendence in nature. But I think the book does that repeatedly. I mean, Howard leaves society and culture, which is so problematic for him, and periodically returns to something that is outside, that is natural, that's primal, and he finds a kind of sustenance there. Even at the very end of the book, when he says he comes out of his job handing out towels at the gym and stands in the parking lot looking at the sky, you know, that's the kind of thing that he does repeatedly.
But going back to what I was kind of sort of not explicitly referencing, but, like, you know, the whole notion of, like, American self-help, or, like, you know, constant sort of, like, you know, devices, whether they be religion or psychiatrists, or even, like, you know, the clinic that that Sylvia is in.
Yeah.
There's a very interesting aspect to this book where there's a certain kind of, like, American reference points. Like, you know, for example, Howard is constantly caught in traffic. There's the 7-Eleven, which constantly sort of crops up. And I was wondering, again, if we, you know, to what extent was, you know, were you thinking in terms of, like, you know, the inability by a lot of people to recognize Howard's consciousness was sort of a plight of, you know, American society?
Very much so. Absolutely. I mean, the book is really about the state of the American dream and his loss of the American dream. Yeah. Parenthetically, I'm intrigued that, you know, the book has been translated in a couple of places, and I'm intrigued that there's interest, because I do think of it as a very, very American book with exactly those kinds of references. Yeah. But, yeah, it's a portrait of a kind of ideal Americana that is troublesome and problematic. And I did want him, I mean, even the idea of the city, which is largely imagined, it's an unnamed Rust Belt city, but that really is also supposed to be the locus of the American dream, and a place where things have not panned out for Howard, but maybe he's not the only one who's been disappointed.
I thought it was a Sly Calvito reference.
Not really. Although I like Calvino, you know, and I love that book a lot, but I wasn't thinking of that. I like making up places. When I was a kid, I had a big train set, and I think it always feels like that. You know, I'm going to put the hospital over here, and I'm going to put the house here, and how am I going to connect them? And so writing about that city was interesting. And in my new book, I'm writing about Rome, and it's a very different thing writing about a real place, and understanding that readers will catch you if you have someone drive down the wrong street.
Well, I guess the Calvino thing kind of comes to mind, because, as I was kind of suggesting, the state of nature at one point, Howard seems to go through, like, the environment constantly sort of shifts.
Mm-hmm.
I never get the sense in this book, I mean, at least when I was reading it, that there is actually sort of a common reference point throughout the various locations. It's almost like each setting is distinct, and there's no sort of carryover in terms of, like, the character of this unknown city.
Well, there are roads, but you're right. It's sort of like different scenes in a play or a movie.
Yeah,
there's the convent, the hospital, the house, the ball fields, and then they're all connected by these arteries.
Yeah, but it's more so than usual. At least there's, like, a common reference point. Like, you know, a lot of other writers, if they're, like, writing about any particular city, they'll, you know, have, like, some sort of motif or metaphor or imagery that will just constantly sort of crop up. But I was wondering why you sort of consciously avoided that decision, why there were these little, you know, as you pointed out, arteries linking these boxes, so to speak.
I think it was something that I did intuitively. I mean, one of the things that Howard refers to repeatedly in his narration is the way the city has changed since his childhood. He's always arriving at some place where he and Sylvia once had a picnic, and now it's a parking lot or a residential development or something like that.
Yeah.
And he lives very much in the past. And so I think having him, you know, move from place to place and say, oh, that's the 7-Eleven where I almost threw up on the hooker.
Yeah.
And that's the, you know, that's the place where we went to see the buzzards. Having him, you know, find these places and have them be changed or you know, completely disappeared, it expresses, again, it just sort of brings us back to that sense of loss, I think.
Or even the sense of America, that it's sort of like maybe disconnected. There is no commonality, perhaps.
Yeah. And he's trying to be part of something that is very, very diffuse, that may not even have a character of its own. I mean, I think that's one of the things that he doesn't state in the book, but he begins to discover that his housemates strike him as representative of American society, but on some level, each of them is just as disappointed or outsider or confused as he is.
And no, I like the Nit and Nat characters, because they I mean, we're here in San Francisco. I live in the Heights, so I see these types of people all the time, these kind of aging semi-hipsters who are just still trying to kind of recapture some. They have no reference point again, and that's the thing. It's like they don't have a reference point, but simultaneously they truly believe that they are bohemian in some sense, so that they are individual in some sense, when in fact there's, you know, again, it's this issue of, like, there's some book that I think is coming out that has recently come out that sort of suggests that, you know, that individualism is some sort of the new conformity or something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
I guess we're seeing more of that.
Yeah, everybody's unique and individual in exactly the same way. You know, just in response to that, one of the paper assignments that I give my freshmen is choose a word that describes yourself. And it's amazing how many in a class of like 20 kids, you'll get 12 kids describing themselves as unique. And, you know, there's the problem. You know, they're all unique, but they're not so unique that they don't choose different words.
Well, it's a trouble. I actually had this conversation the other night with, like, a friend where we were talking about, like, how Hallmark has sort of co-opted language mm-hmm. so that you can't really even be sincere anymore because, like, particularly when you're describing something like love or something or even feelings, it's like the language itself has been so co-opted that if you say, like, yeah, this is how I feel, you know, I care for you, and it's like you can't say that.
Right.
Because then it's, I mean, this must have presented something of a challenge for you in terms of keeping the sympathy. It's like, I was wondering, did you keep like a list of words or phrases that are
I didn't do that, but it that was exactly the challenge, and I think it was a heightened challenge because my storyline is also relatively familiar and, you know, very you know, potentially very trite. You know, this is a kind of classic, almost mythic story. Misfit adult and misfit child come together and heal each other's wounds. You know, there's the literary version of that, which is probably Huckleberry Finn, but then there's a million, like, sitcoms and, you know, horrible bad movies and stuff that also evoke that tale. And at one point I did take a brush with red paint and make a whole list of all the predecessors I could think of on the wall of my studio. It's painted over now, but... but it was a kind of reminder to just, you know, since I was working in this established structure, to, you know, to not be trite, to not be cliched. And I think the book follows that roadmap for a certain way, and then in the last third, it spins off in a direction that hopefully most readers won't recognize. And I think that's maybe what redeems... The familiarity of some of the plot elements.
Do you think that the state of contemporary fiction is such where that is not... No, the writers of today who are trying to be sincere and trying to do so in a way that is, you know, not sort of like hitting people over the head with the treacle, you know, do you think that fiction today is succeeding at this? Do you think that it's because of these issues we've been sort of talking about?
You know, it's hard for me to say what the state of American fiction is, but I do think that there are writers who succeed at that. I mean, a recent book that I can think of that does that very well is Matthew Sharpe's The Sleeping Father. And I think he also was trying to do something that was moving but get at it in a very oblique way. And I really admire that book. I can really only talk about what I'm trying to do, though, and I certainly felt that I was trying to resist. I was trying to resist, you know, sort of easy snarkiness, which is just so present around us that it didn't feel like something I wanted to work on for a number of years.
The ha-ha itself mm-hmm. in the book. It's very interesting to me because on one hand it's a symbol, but on another hand it's an environmental detail. I mean, it isn't one or the other, which makes it to me a unique sort of piece of imagery. And in fact, you know, a lot of the sort of description is sort of like that throughout the book in terms of inhabiting that gray area. And I was wondering if again, you might want to, you know, comment upon how you stumbled upon the ha-ha, number one. And number two, more importantly, because you've already answered the, what is a ha-ha? It's a ditch, and, you know, that kind of thing. Why wasn't it exclusively a symbol or exclusively an environmental detail? I mean, what...
Well, the classic definition, now I'm going to be the English teacher, but the classic definition of a symbol that I teach my students is that a symbol is... something which is both itself and an abstract idea.
Okay.
And that's really the way I used the ha-ha. I will just say that a ha-ha is a way of dividing up large tracts of land by creating a ditch in the land rather than a fence.
Yeah.
And it has the effect of kind of an optical illusion, so the land appears to go on forever. And this is the way it's used in the book. I tossed it in. I first heard about Ahaha in a undergraduate history of architecture class, and because I was the kind of painting student who liked optical illusions and tricks of the eye, I remembered it. And I tossed it into the first draft thinking, oh, here's something that I will inevitably take out before too long. I'm the kind of writer who deletes a lot. I write a lot and then I delete a lot. And I just thought, well, this will sort of be a placeholder for now for some other thing that I'll refine later. But as it turned out, as I wrote the story, and I didn't really have a plan for a plot in mind, so I was feeling my way with the plot, as I wrote the story, I began returning to the ha-ha again and again and using it. And furthermore, I did begin to see that it was kind of symbolic. But it's symbolic in a lot of ways that not all readers agree about. My sense of it was that there's a kind of unaddressed fissure in the landscape of Howard's life, which is that although he's very aware of his brain injury, he hasn't fully accommodated it. And so there's this hidden danger or, you know, what's that term they use in golf? Oh, I'm blanking.
Birdie? grandmother would know.
Sorry.
This.
Yeah. Anyway, a hidden obstacle in the landscape.
Oh, the sand and, trap?
A hidden trap or something like that. Which is his brain injury. And that was the way I intended to use that. But readers have written to me and said, well, you know, they think Howard himself is sort of a ha-ha in that he's, you know, he's a kind of danger that is that nobody sees. You know, he's someone who's wired to go off at any moment and, you know, could become dangerous or crazy if he let himself go. And so readers have had a lot of interpretations, but that was mine.
Well, I have a totally different one.
Okay.
I viewed
glad to hear it.
Well, my idea of the ha-ha was that, again, I sort of read your book as kind of like, you know, look, we should recognize all human beings to some degree, that all human beings, no matter how debilitated, have some kind of, you know, consciousness and cognition and feelings. I viewed sort of the ha-ha as kind of like, you know, both Howard's inability to kind of go from one strip of land to another, while simultaneously Americans, the American kind of impulse to sort of like stick within one particular territory as opposed to sort of expand. I mean, you know, keep in mind, like, for example, like, there's only like, I think the statistic is like 20-30% of Americans actually have a passport. Mm. Most Americans don't travel compared to like any other nation. And
that's
how,
amazing.
You know, yeah, it is. And so, I don't know. I guess I viewed it as a sort of, you know, a kind of, I don't know, cultural consciousness.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, yeah. And he is, you know, he is bound in his little area of the field. He doesn't have the kind of freedom that we think he should have, you know.
Yeah.
He looks at the landscape, which is spread out all on all sides around him, but essentially he's kind of bound in one little area. Very smart.
Well, it's not just him, though. I think it's also like the Sister, Amity forces are kind of keeping him confined because they want to, like, correct him. Strangely enough, I actually drew a connection. I'm now rambling off here. But I drew a connection between, like, the kind of satire in, like, Kubrick's adaptation of A Clockwork Orange, where all the people are trying to reform Alex. And this isn't quite so much there in the Burgess novel. But it's one of those really kinds of funny little satirical things where every single force, whether it be prison or religion or, like, intellectuals, are trying to reform Alex, but they fail, A, to understand him, or, B, to, you know, grant him any kind of rights to sort of think on his own and come to his own sort of conclusion, which incidentally is in the book, but not in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Burgess was pissed off about that. So I view this as kind of carrying off in that sort of Western society kind of...
I think that's true. And back to the point you made earlier about self-help, I mean, there's a lot of skepticism about, you know, how you improve yourself. I mean, I think Sylvia's last scene, readers who want to will find that as an endorsement of, you know, the substance abuse industry. But...
Yeah.
Many readers will find it very much not an endorsement of that industry. You know, that Sylvia is cured, but is she really any better off? Is she just mouthing a lot of platitudes? And
I didn't think she was totally cured. I certainly didn't find. I found that she was now it's me. I found that she was just like, you know, particularly that scene where, you know, Howard comes and she's just still just as exploitive, just as like leeching, and really yeah. it's just she thinks that being in the clinic will somehow by way of being there, she will actually have healed. She will actually have resolved her problems.
It's given her some kind of seal of approval or something.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that was
what I was getting at. I mean, I am skeptical of kind of pat, easy solutions to things.
Yeah. Now, I know that this film has been optioned. However, mm-hmm. I'm a little worried because Akiva Goldsman, who isn't exactly the most subtle screenwriter on the earth, is actually lined up to adapt this thing in some capacity. Does this issue kind of worry you, because, or will it lead people back to the book, or does the book sort of stand on its own, or do you not care about the film adaptation? Or?
I
know you're going to have to be very careful about this, but
I hope it will lead people back to the book. I've only seen the first draft of the script, and I think there will be others. So I don't want to comment too heavily on it. I think there are things that the script does very, very well, and there have been some changes, and many of them I think are interesting. One thing, for example, is they've decided to set Howard's injury in the first Gulf War rather than in Vietnam. Huh. I had imagined, of course, you know, a sexy older actor like Ed Harris or Robert Duvall or even Bruce Willis, you know, in the role. And I can understand that the market forces need someone who's a little more hunk-friendly. And as of now, this may change tomorrow, but as of now, I understand they're talking to Johnny Depp and Brad Pitt about playing that role. And that seems fine to me. That seems like a perfectly sensible, defensible thing. And you know, my story is not about the evils of a particular war, but about the evils of war. The thing I hope they don't do is make Howard too much of a kind of Superman. I think there's a risk, and you mentioned subtlety, I think there's a risk that Howard will become a kind of gung-ho Marine out of Jarhead. And, you know, that he'll be this guy who can do anything. Whereas one of the things that I really struggled with in the book was to give Howard ordinariness and decency and to have those be his key characteristics. And I think if he becomes a kind of cartoonish super guy, then something will be lost. And I believe it would be a better and more interesting and probably a more profitable movie if they allowed him to be the everyman that I created.
Well, there's also the problem of the fact this is what makes the book work, and this is what makes it a, you know, piece of literature, is in that the perspective is only, we only hear it from Howard's point of view, and no one else can hear them. And I actually was, when I first read the book, I was sort of thinking to myself, there is absolutely no way they can turn this into a movie.
So that's what I thought.
When I heard the news, I was like thinking, like, you know, there is no way you can do this without sort of jeopardizing this kind of insularity of Howard's.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only way they could do it is through some sort of really cheeseball voiceover.
They're not going to do that.
Oh.
We've talked about that. I don't think it's a good idea. Yeah. Akiva doesn't think it's a good idea.
Well, that's good.
But at the same time, it's necessary to acknowledge that my book is really a text. It's really a... it's kind of, in some ways, an extended monologue, and in that sense, it's a very literary work, and the film has to be as filmic as the book is literary.
Yeah.
So they're going to make some changes. I mean, I do think that the film will be... it'll be more about plot and action, because that's what films are. You won't get the fine nuances of Howard's voice, but hopefully if you go back and read the book, then you'll find that stuff there. And a really good actor will convey some of that. Now, the risk there is that because Howard doesn't speak very much, there's the risk that the action will somehow transfer to the other characters and that they'll become the center of attention. And I think that's a very delicate balance that someone will have to address, and I hope they get that right. You know, I would hate to see it become essentially a film about, say, Ryan and Laurel, with Howard kind of always standing around in the background.
That's the thing I've also thought about, too. I was in that, the nature of Hollywood being what it is, you get another sort of, like, actor involved. You know, you're going to need some sort of, like, actor with huge clout in the role of Howard.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone else for Ryan or whoever is going to either have to be humble as hell, which is hard to find in Hollywood, not a line counter. And then you also have to get a director who is, like, going to shoot the thing entirely from Howard's perspective.
Yeah.
Meaning, like, you know, Howard is, you know, have, like, lots of shots of close-ups or something. I don't know. I mean, it almost seems very much hinged upon its execution. And I'm very, very worried because it's like, it's a good book. And I'm like, oh, no.
That's what I would do. I mean, as a former film student, I obviously have ideas about how I would approach the problem. And I would keep it very close to his perspective.
Yeah.
Whether they end up doing that or not, you know, I can't really say. I mean, I hope it's a good film.
And who knows what the audience tests are going to turn
yeah,
it into?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, at least we have the book here, you know, to go from. Well, Dave, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, yeah. Edward. I really enjoyed it.
If
you
want help, you better ask me and
I. So be sincere, convince me with a pretty please. Laugh, laugh, I thought I'd die. It seems so funny to me. Laugh, laugh, you met a guy, taught you how it feels to be lonely, ooh, so lonely. Don't think I'm being funny when I say you got just what you deserve.